Welcome to the Baker McKenzie podcast series, Solutions for a Connected World. In this episode, we're taking a look at how businesses can stay the course in a shifting geopolitical landscape. I'm joined today by two experts to help discuss this important topic. They are Sunny Mann, partner at Baker McKenzie, who chairs the firm's international trade team and leads its geopolitical risk task force. Joining Sunny is Kai Chan, Global CEO Ocean Freight at ISS Global Forwarding. For four decades, the growing flows of cross-border trade, people, services, data, and ideas were the dominant forces shaping the world. It was the era defined by globalization. But in the face of war, pandemic, populism, mass migration, and climate change, the international consensus has frayed. The political landscape that businesses now operate in is highly uncertain, and 2024 could dramatically redraw the political map with 40 countries holding elections. Retrenchment, resilience, onshoring, friendshoring, nationalism, and localism are the new narratives dominating business conversations. So with that in mind, Sunny, can you give some context to the geopolitical environment businesses are finding themselves in?
Sure. So it is really quite fast-moving and interesting times that we live in at the moment. And I don't think I've ever known a level of disruption of this magnitude that businesses are having to navigate and grapple with, A, as part of their strategic thinking, but also B, as part of their business as usual day-to-day activities as well. So if you think about it, the most obvious and ongoing example of geopolitical disruption at the moment is a fallout still being felt from the invasion by Russia of Ukraine. No one really was adequately prepared for the fallout that was experienced. I can understand why that wouldn't have been part of companies' contingency planning. When you are going to a company and fundamentally saying to them that you have to take out and excise what was the 11th largest economy in the world from your manufacturing base, from your employee base, and from your supply chains, that was one huge and very material undertaking that companies perhaps weren't prepared for. So the Russia example, though, Tom, is perhaps the most current one that companies are focused on. But over recent years, we've seen geopolitical disruption emerge from other scenarios as well. You think back to Brexit. You think about the US under the Trump administration initially commencing trade wars, even with some of the closest trading allies like the EU, the UK and Canada. You think about the scrutiny of trade with China or the fallout from the COVID pandemic. Geopolitical disruption is very much part of the new normal, and the business community really needs to adapt to that as part of its strategic thinking.
Thanks, Sunny. You mentioned US trade relations with China. We're in a US election year, and Trump has indicated that if he regains the White House, he's vowed to put a 10% tariff on all imports to the US. BlackRock, in October 2023, still listed the strategic competition between US and China as the top geopolitical risk affecting world markets. Taking a step back then, could you give us a broader overview of trade and investment with China?
There's clearly a lot more scrutiny related to trade and investment involving China. You think of foreign investment controls, they're much more prevalent and they're much more commonly deployed to intervene in potential investments and acquisitions. And it happens to be the case that Chinese investors in particular are commonly in the receiving end of a lot of those controls. You think of export controls targeting sharing of sensitive goods, software and technology, like semiconductors or AI or encryption. And a lot of that, again, is focused on trade with China. You think of sanctions targeting actors who are considered to raise sensitivities from a national security perspective. And again, I can envisage more sanctions regulations over time targeting China as well. But also things like customs tariffs, duties, anti-dumping duties. Now, stepping back from it, there's a few things also to be clear about, which is I don't think anyone serious today is credibly talking about a decoupling of the Chinese economy from the West. It is just not realistic. We're not talking about a Russia Mark II here, where the global economy was able to pretty much decouple from the Russian economy. With China, that is just not going to happen. There are still very strong levels of trade and investment involving China, and that will continue into the future. But for companies, it is all about how you navigate the increasing levels of regulatory expectations. And it is possible to navigate them. Trade and investment involving China will still continue into the future, albeit with a greater degree of regulatory spotlight and scrutiny involved. You're right to say that there was an increase in scrutiny involving China when the Trump administration came into power. That said, even under the Biden administration, we didn't really see them rolling back a lot of those regulations that the Trump administration brought out. So in a certain sense, I think irrespective of who is in the White House after the next election, there will still be that regulatory scrutiny and spotlight involving China.
Kai, let's bring you in here. What consequences will US-China trade relations have for the flow of trade?
Well, I mean, you just named the countries that are actually quite self-sustaining. So if they just look into their own country domestically, they could actually benefit from just inverted view. For their international trade, they need to have good partners. In the old days, as we like to say, production in China used to be quite reasonably priced. That is the most challenging part now, because if you do not know where to get the lowest price production for the same quality, everything becomes lopsided. I'll give you a good example. It used to be that automotive batteries and even food will be imported from China, imported from United States, because from anywhere else, the scope of the land is not big enough to provide it that low price. But I think the world has changed in the meantime, that a lot of countries are now looking into how could we not be so dependent on these two biggest countries and regions anymore, because the political instability of not knowing who's the next president, not knowing what are the rules and laws that change overnight all of a sudden because they can, it becomes so challenging for the businesses that they have to find alternatives. Also, if you look at the Red Sea, Middle East situation right now, it takes much longer than expected to ship from A to B. So the question is, do we now slow down the production in the factories, or do we just change the resourcing and procurement way or planning that we've done so far?
So Kai, with big geopolitical and regulatory shifts bringing uncertainty for businesses, how do you prepare for the implementation of new rules and regulations?
I honestly don't know how to answer this to you, because we get the information most probably same time as everybody else. And to prepare for the unknown, I mean, 2-3 years ago, we didn't know certain things would happen. And so there are alternatives for sure. If you're a big corporation, there are always backup plans, but the backup plans were never put in place because you didn't know what are the rules. When it hits you, what are the rules all of a sudden? So I used to work based in China in Shanghai, and we were importing from around the world consumer goods. And you knew the trading tax is something between 1-3%, the import taxation of this good. And all of a sudden, there were two leaders in the world don't like each other anymore. And so all of a sudden, that product that I was importing from that country spiked within 6 months into 30%. So now you imagine from 1% to 30%, I was not prepared for that. So you can only prepare if you have an army of people. But honestly speaking, I haven't seen in my 30 years the perfect preparation for these kind of scenarios.
Nearshoring and reshoring has become a more dominant discussion for global businesses. There are risks and opportunities with what some call a China Plus One policy. Sunny, your thoughts on this?
So I think the business that is going to thrive most through the current turbulence is the one that is not overly exposed to any single market, whether it's China or another market, frankly. But it's also that business that is best placed to adapt to unexpected turbulence. So if you take the classic example where companies are now reflecting whether they need to diversify their manufacturing and supply chain, so there isn't that over-reliance on one particular market, companies with respect to China are exploring a China Plus One or a China Plus Two strategy. And they're looking at options including, you know, friendshoring into ASEAN markets or India. They're talking about, you know, a lot of US corporations are talking about nearshoring into Mexico. And a lot of companies globally are just talking about inshoring back to their domestic market. And so many of our lawyers around the globe at the moment are advising clients on investment regimes across multiple markets to help assess which market may be best placed to support that diversification of their supply chain. And that entails a closer review of things like foreign investment controls, tax regimes, customs regs, employment regs. And what you can see is that through that assessment, there are actually multiple opportunities there for companies to reduce their risk profile, but also to pursue potential growth-enhancing opportunities in markets where there may be a number of business-friendly regimes at play at the moment.
Kai, there is this difficulty for businesses to decide whether they stick with their normal supply chains that can be affected by geopolitics, or whether they nearshore, which could increase costs. So how do they pivot? How do they maintain the ability to take advantage of both? That's a major challenge, right?
I'm in this business or in trading and shipping and logistics for over 30 years. If I look at it from a European standpoint or from a North America standpoint or from an Asia Pacific standpoint, we tend to forget there has been always for the longest time the up and coming African region and the Middle Eastern region, and a lot of investments in new productions and consumers are coming from there. If you look at how they balance now, and leave alone the solar and renewable energy production and orders, it has changed. We are not looking at the modern Western world alone anymore to lead us into the new chapter, but it's also the Chinese production is neither cheap nowadays, nor is it bad quality. It's rather the opposite. So that gives a lot of businesses food for thought, long time already. How are we diversifying our business now to satisfy a certain amount of new consumers, which are very important because these today new consumers will be old consumers tomorrow. So this kind of investment, they have to do. I tell you, one of my famous customers used to produce their furnitures at a certain place where they knew it's going to be reasonable price, it will be finished on time, and it's good quality. But now they're looking into maybe a shift of percentage, because the customers are also asking, why do you not produce nearby? Why don't you look into that kind of production rather than always going to the usual place that you are? And the copyrights are also shifting. It's not only one area now copy the best innovation, but also it's all over the places now.
All of this really comes back to building flexibility and resilience. How can businesses build resilience to these big global risks? Sunny, what's your advice here?
So one of the things that's keeping my global team busy at the moment is this whole idea of geopolitical risk assessment, assessing risk readiness from a geopolitical perspective. So yes, that does involve, as a starting point, looking at whether your manufacturing and your supply chain is overly exposed to any particular market out there where there is that potential for geopolitical instability. But then you start assessing the new markets and what opportunities they present. You look at the market entry rules for that particular market. What is the welcome basket, in essence, that they're offering? You know, are there investment treaty protections? Are there benign foreign investment controls? Is there a free trade agreement in place that offers frictionless trade opportunities? Is there preferential access available? You know, are there generous tax incentives? But then also looking at the ongoing ease of cross-border activity once you've got that operation up and running. So are there punitive customs duties, or is that market the common target of anti-dumping tariffs? Are there tight export controls and sanctions regimes in place? You'd also then want to look at things like, you know, the local regulatory environment and the predictability of operating in that market. So, for example, you know, what is the rule of law? Is there a respectful rule of law in that country? Is there ready access to a reliable judicial system if there is a contractual dispute with a partner? You know, are IP rights protected? You'd then look at practical issues like reliable access to labor, availability of raw materials. Is there a strong local infrastructure and manufacturing base? What about the local technological capabilities and broadband, for example? But there are costs, as you say, and it's working out which market out there is going to reduce those costs and offer opportunities that allow a successful expansion into new markets.
And Kai, how are you building supply chain resilience?
So now, how to build up resilience is you need to look at change. And change is not a bad word. Resilience, for me, since you're asking me, is a huge part of opportunities, and an opportunity is a natural change. You need to look at the areas that you never had before in order to stabilize yourself. Procurement, operation, transportation. If we're talking about vessels, shipping lines, the container vessels that have been protected in the Red Sea to go through the Suez, right? They are carrying nowadays, in average, 20,000 containers. And these 20,000 containers need to be filled. They're massive. So my question is, how do we now make sure that we are not only relying on this mass satisfaction of big vessels, but also on smaller areas where we are still having terms of need? And small, people will laugh it out about it when I say it, intra-Asia. A lot of people in intra-Asia, if you look at the population, China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, huge population in a part of Asia, intra-Asia. So do we really need big, huge vessels to serve these countries within the scope? My question is, are all the businesses and the logistic companies are looking at areas where they might have not been so focused on?
Global trade grew a miserly 0.7% in 2023. While HSBC predicts that 2024 could see a 1.8% growth in trade and 3.5% in 2025, geopolitics and major elections this year could still pose downside risk. According to HSBC again, China still remains the top exporter to 70 economies globally. Thus, a larger reworking of the macro trade flows will take a while to be seen. In short, with the continued geopolitical uncertainty, business leaders must bolster themselves against risks and remain flexible to opportunities by strategically planning, adapting, and anticipating. One thing is certain, businesses must build resilient supply chains more than ever.